I mean, it was months of these conversations. And every time it was like we were moving forward and it was one step closer to this baby. I pictured that baby. I held that baby. I imagined that baby in preschool. And so I lost a baby, really. But people don't understand that.
Hey, I'm Kelly Corrigan, and wondering is what I do best. Lately, I've been wondering how change really happens for a culture or a country, for an organization or a family. If you're a serious Club Wonder person, you'll remember that last month we took some time to talk about how end of life is changing across our culture. And those conversations made me wonder how the beginning of life is changing. Kelly Corrigan Wonders is a place for people who believe that knowing more and feeling more will help us do more and be better. I'm glad you're here. We'll be right back. Hey, I'm Kelly Corrigan, and today we're talking about how the many ways we make family are changing. I have two stories and one short reading from a book I wrote years ago called Lift, about how the beginning of life is changing across America. So in 1978, a little girl named Louise Joy Brown was the first test tube baby born on planet Earth. Since then, hundreds of thousands of babies have been born through IVF. But there are other ways, too. I remember a few months back, I got super choked up when Anderson Cooper posted about becoming a dad and his gratitude for the surrogate who carried his son Wyatt. And then recently, I read this incredible piece, which you may have read, too, in The Atlantic, about a guy who was called, quote, the perfect donor, and his sperm was used to make 36 children over 15 years. And this guy said he had an IQ of 160 and he was getting his doctorate in neuroscience, but really he was a college dropout with serious mental health issues and a criminal record. In my inner circle alone, some of the women I love most in the world were forced to find unconventional technology-enabled ways to become mothers. My college friend did 11 IVFs. My camp friend adopted twice. My family friend used a surrogate. Our old babysitter, who is like family to me, just froze her eggs. My friend Meg, who I'm going to talk about today, used a sperm bank. The very first person I knew to go through the hell of infertility was my college pal, Tracy, who is a woman of strong Christian faith and now a family therapist finishing her PhD with research work on supportive relationships. So I know your story because we're old, old, old pals, but will you just give us the beats of your story? Because I know it was just hell to have your first kid.
Yeah, my story is that I was 30 when I married my now husband, and I had always had an irregular cycle. And so after a year being 30, you're like, okay, let's see what's going on here. Nothing happened. So I kind of knew I had some issues. So we dove in, and it was 3 years of scientific experimentation.
What was the first thing that you tried other than just good old fashioned sex?
We tried, you know, naturally for a year, but given, you know, my age and my history with my ovulation, you know, it was suspect. And just being the person that I am, I just wanted to get in and find out.
Isn't it funny to think that your age at 30, I mean, you have people having babies at 52, 55 now.
Yeah, don't say that because I'm 54 in February and I don't want to have another baby. Yes, but so 30 is young, right? People today, young professionals, they're not even starting. And that's fine. I guess for me, it wasn't that I felt old, but I had a sense something was going on.
You were a person who just wanted to be a mom so much.
I did. Yep. And that was important to me. I wasn't involved in a career that, you know, needed me to wait.
Right.
So we jumped in and we just, you know, tried Clomid's the first thing. You just try to get you ovulating.
Were you and your husband on the same page? Like, was he equally urgent or was he kind of like, oh, Tracy, slow your roll. Don't worry about it. It's going to happen.
He's a supportive person. He just is and has been and was during that time. It was important to me. It was important to him.
Uh-huh.
And he got it. So he was along for the ride.
But are you driving? Are you the one who's saying, I think we should try this. I think we should try that. I want to go to the doctor.
Yes, in the beginning, well, it's my body, you know, and mm-hmm. I am the researcher and the tenacious one and, you know, a little competitive and this is something I want, so I'm going to get it. I'm not sure exactly when we jumped to IVF, but we tried, you know, methods of just trying to get me to ovulate and all the testing, right? So we uncovered that I have a congenital deformed fallopian tube that they ended up removing at some point. Like, who knew? I was only ovulating if I ever ovulated off of one side. He had, you know, not perfect sperm.
And was there a tension around discovering whose fault it was, quote unquote? Because I could imagine that that would be a little sensitive.
Yeah. I think it was hard for both of us. You know, the biggest sort of problem with this kind of obstacle in life is it's so easy to quickly turn to, there's something wrong with me. Mm-hmm. You know?
There's so much terminology that I feel like is accusatory. Like, isn't there something about like an inhospitable uterus or...
Yeah.
Right? There's like some...
Right.
Terms that I think, there's no way a woman came up with that phrase.
Right. It reminds me of being in labor with Annie and they called it unproductive labor. And I was like, you don't call labor unproductive.
If that man gets a little closer to me, I'm going to strangle him.
I can't remember with Mike, you know, surely, yeah, it's like a little emasculating to find out your sperm aren't large in count and all healthy.
Right.
And they tell you how they have two heads. You're just like, what?
I mean,
it's not comforting.
Right. I mean, it's such bliss to roll around in the hay and make a baby the old-fashioned way and never have to know the gory details of your insides.
Yes.
Because there is the potential for shame or guilt that you're a little bit broken.
Absolutely. It's all over it.
I mean, I even felt that with breast cancer.
For sure.
Like at one point I looked to Edward and said, I'm so sorry. Like you just do not deserve this. You're a good man. You should not have to go through this.
Yeah.
And he kind of looked at me like, what are you talking about?
Right. This is not your fault. I know, but we are sort of bent that way. And I feel like it's taken all of my 53 years to finally see that sometimes bad things happen in life to people and it's not your fault.
You're a therapist now. You're finishing your PhD and to think about how many people need to be held by the shoulders and looked in the eye and have someone convincing say to them with authority, it's not your fault.
You could do a whole series on that because that changes brain chemistry. Mm. Literally. My research is about supportive relationships and going through this process. There were supportive relationships that were there to reflect to me the truth of what I was going through so I didn't get caught in, you know, the lies.
Right, that you didn't make up a story about it that wasn't true and then really fall for your own story.
Yeah, and then, you know, just give into it.
That's so interesting. I was talking to my friend Andy about his wife, Liz, who died of ovarian cancer, and there was a sense of failure that they had failed, that they had not come up with the solution. And they're such, both of them, such smart people and so resourceful and hadn't really had a scenario where it was like, oh, that's just not going to work.
That's the American dream, right? You can achieve whatever you want if you just work hard enough, are smart enough, and know the right people. Right. And the reality is it's not true. Like, it's not true. Right. You know, the world is harsh.
Did you come to feel that in the end you were able to have three children so that you were able to muscle through this problem?
I did. And looking back, I don't know that my journey is everybody's journey, right? Like, it's just my journey. So we had amazing coverage at the time that you can't even get now because, you know, people started pursuing fertility treatments and companies weren't shelling out the money. But I think we blew through like $80,000 and we did 11 transfers, 8 to get pregnant with Annie and 3 more with Nick. I had a miscarriage and that really just showed me that I could get pregnant. So that was actually devastating, but also, you know, brought hope. And both of my two IVF kids, Annie and Nick, were both twins up until like 8 weeks. And, you know, the philosophy there is that extra embryo was producing hormones that let them stick. So just fascinating. And so 3 years of that, and yes, I'm able to give birth to this daughter and then a year and a half later, a son. And then, I mean, the kicker of my story is that, you know, at your 6-week postpartum, they say you're good to go. You can go, you know, romp in the hay with your hubby.
Yeah.
Well, a friend had told me, she said, you know, it's not going to feel good till you've done it 10 times after you've had a baby. So I was like, all right, well, then you got to get your 10 times in.
So let's get busy, baby.
It was Christmas. I was clocking my 10, and I don't know. My OB had said, you know, what about birth control after Nick, my second one? And I said, oh, please, please.
Right. You gotta be kidding
me. The stars would have to be aligned. Like, seriously, I just went through 11 IVF transfers. Right. And sure enough, 8 weeks, Christmas, postpartum. And I remember feeling like a teenager having sex because I knew what fertile mucus was and I had it.
Oh.
And I'm literally breastfeeding my baby and I got pregnant. My beautiful miracle surprise boy.
I'll never forget the phone call.
Yeah, just crazy. Crazy.
Because to be honest, to be totally honest, when you were doing these 11 IVFs, your friends who love you to pieces, like me and Tracy Tuttle and the rest of the gang, were super worried that you were on a road to nowhere.
Yeah.
That somebody at some point was going to have to say to you, Tracy, this isn't going to happen.
This isn't your road.
Like, God bless your sweetheart, but there's no way you're going to get blood from a stone. You've got to stop doing this to yourself. Because it was torture.
Right.
It's all
it was
like
torture.
High fives and giggles now, but it was such torture. I mean, there were just 1,000 tears.
1,000. So here's the interesting part of that is that I said enough's enough. After I had the miscarriage, I had one more cycle that I was all up for because I thought for sure I'm going to get pregnant again and it's going to stick. And it didn't. And I was devastated. And I said to Mike, I'll never forget, my best friend Heather had gone through and not pursued it as much as me and had turned to adoption and had just, you know, recently adopted this beautiful boy. And I said, I'm done. Like, I'm done. I just want a baby. I just want a baby in my hands. And like, I don't need to do this anymore. And I want to adopt. And I will never forget him looking at me, you know, so much of this brings in all kinds of moral things too, right? We had embryos in the freezer. And he looked at me and he said, okay, you know, I'm down for that, but not till we've used those embryos in the freezer.
Mm.
And him being strong when I was weak, I was like, okay, you're right. Let me get my head straight. Let's take a break and let me go back at it. And I got pregnant with Annie that next cycle.
Mm.
It makes me want to cry.
Aww, lovey.
Because she knows like her dad fought for her.
Aww.
I might've left her in the freezer. And we laugh about it now.
Aww.
But yeah, crazy. So I did give up. And it would have been okay if I gave up, you know, except that Annie was in the freezer. It would have been okay. I don't think that this is for everybody. You know, it was my journey. It fit me. It's how our family came to be.
When you back out and look at it from more of a distance and the opportunities for all women everywhere, well, all women everywhere with insurance, to have a family this way, is it a net positive? Is it a net negative? What are the unintended consequences of this huge change in science's ability to solve a problem that formerly could only be done one way?
I knew at some point while you were interviewing me, I would say these three words. I don't know.
Mm.
You know, the more I know, the more I don't know. I, you know, obviously wouldn't want to trade these three beings for anything in the world. I am so glad that science was there for me when my broken body wasn't. I don't know.
You're a pretty devout Christian.
Yeah. Strong faith. Leaned heavily into it during that whole time. I once had a conversation with a woman who was actually didn't know how my babies came to be and said, you know, how horrible, you know, IVF was and making embryos and doing God's work. And I had to say to her, you know, my three kids, two of them are test tube babies. They were made in a hospital lab. She melted, right? Because you don't know until you know. I don't know what the answer is to that. I just don't. It's complicated science. Where would we be with cancer without science? Where would we be with this pandemic without science?
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, God is in the science. God is in the brains of the scientists. He's in the chemistry of the science. Like for me, God is in all that. And I just think it's beautiful.
Mm. Did you use all your embryos?
So we did not use all our embryos. So you could put them up for adoption. You could donate them to science or have them destroyed. And we donated them to science.
Mm-hmm.
I do not have the answers. I felt selfish not putting them up for adoption. And I will tell you, it's not something I could do. Just wasn't. Science felt like a good option. Do I think there's a possibility I'm going to get to heaven someday and see my little people? Maybe. You know, I don't know. I'm not going to say I know for sure how this all works. Mm-hmm. There's so many layers. I mean, we could talk about, hey, if you just relaxed, would you have gotten pregnant, and how that's so offensive, mm-hmm. right? And yet now where I am as a marriage and family therapist, like studying toxic stress from childhood, I think there's a whole lot of validity to that. And I think the more we know about how toxic stress affects us physically, the more we can learn about really holistically treating people going through whatever they're going through.
Mm-hmm. Like, I remember strongly hearing from a doctor in a very convincing way that belly fat and breast cancer were connected. And I thought, oh my God, this is my fault.
Yep. See, it's my fault.
Because I'm a sloppy eater and sort of indulgent and don't really exercise. And there you go.
Yeah. And so it's all shifting now, though. So the survey that my research is on is called the ACE survey. I don't know if you've heard of it.
Mm-mm.
It quantifies and assesses adverse childhood experiences. So you answer these 9 questions and you get a score. And they're not obvious, you know, they're subtle. Not feeling loved, you know, certainly physical and sexual abuse, but and your parents divorcing or separating. But there's you know, not feeling loved, feeling hungry. The research shows that people who score higher on that survey go on to have health issues.
Mm.
Like it's huge. The Surgeon General, Nadia Burke-Harris out in California, you probably know her name, mm-hmm. Is doing all kinds of things in California with this. What we say with this now is there's not something wrong with you. Some things happen to you. So then if we look at it that way and can talk about it with compassion, then we can enter in with a causal effect. Like actually, Tracy, some things that happened to you may have shifted your biology and your hormones in such a way that things that happen to you are causing this.
I was interviewing Tara Westover, the woman who wrote Educated.
Phenomenal book. Yeah, amazing.
She's really interested in the intersection of physiology and behaviors and abuses.
It's all in the brain. And you talked about it in one of your interviews.
Oh yeah, Dacher Keltner.
It's the brain, like it's the neurology. So what we've learned is that the brain is plastic, epigenetics. Your DNA can get changed from stress and changed from self-compassion and compassion. We're self-healers. And we're just figuring it out. Like it's just mind-blowing.
Well, it's also cause for terrific optimism.
Yes.
Like just the idea of plasticity. We are built to survive. We are built for resilience. Like,
yep, for change.
Things can be corrected.
And supportive relationships, you talked about that and you have talked about that. I had support groups and online groups going through this infertility stuff. It was everything to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what changes the brain is your relationship to people changes the brain. And so you can be a person who says, oh, it's not my fault. I am loved. There is a loving God. Or for, you know, people who don't have faith or have different faith, I call it the benevolence of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Like the universe is benevolent. Our brains are benevolent. There's hope. It's all tied together.
Thanks so much. I love talking to you.
Love you, Kel.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
So before we dive in with Lori Gottlieb, I wanted to set up this conversation with a passage that I wrote way back in 2010. My kids were very little, and one of my all-time favorite people, Meg Garlinghouse, was deciding whether or not to pursue having a baby on her own. Sometimes, when I'm with my kids, I kind of shake my head and say Meg's name out loud, almost like a prayer, which means that I'm thinking about how unfazed she'd be by the Play-Doh in your teeth or how much she would like the fairy hut you built. Or the way you made yourself a math worksheet and then filled in all the answers and gave yourself a big A+. I want her to have this thing I have that's so ordinary and tedious and aggravating and then so divine. It's no small thing to encourage someone to become a single parent, to take on the bottomless work and cost and heartache that comes with children. Dad thought I might not want to push it. He thought Meg would do fine with the logistics and frustrations, the blocking and tackling, as he put it. He was more worried about the unknowns. What if she adopts and the parents show up later and want the kid back? What if her child turns out to have a genetic disease or deep, unresolvable anger? What if some future boyfriend walks away saying he really loves her kid, but he wants to have his own? That conversation slowed me a bit. But then Dad's a man, and he was talking about regret. I just couldn't imagine it would come to that. Mothers never come to regret their children, right? Not the mother of the trisomy baby who was born with his intestines on the outside and only lives for weeks. Not the mother of the schizophrenic on America's Most Wanted. Not the mother of the 56-year-old who lives at home and drinks in the morning. No mother regrets her child. The weekend Meg turned 40, we drove to Tomales Bay. On the ride up, we got talking about our first road trip 12 years before to Lake Tahoe. "You know the first thing I liked about you," I said, "you blush." "I don't know anyone who blushes," she laughed. "I don't, and I think it's so funny because you're such a competent person. I mean, you're not silly or girly or even remotely giddy, you know?" "Yes," she said, "although," she glanced at a CD in her car door pocket. "Yes, there is that. That has always troubled me." Meg is the only person I know who listens, unironically, to John Denver. She cried when they announced his plane had crashed. She also loved Titanic, a crap movie that got way too much credit. But other than those two flaws, which are probably linked by some kind of rogue gene, Meg is solid. "You know what I liked about you," Meg said? "You didn't hold anything back. You were just right out there." But I was holding something back. Partly because we are, all of us, always holding things back. And partly because I was nervous, afraid that as soon as I'd said what I wanted to say, she'd think I'd given up on her chances for marriage, or worse, that I never believed they were particularly good to begin with. "I have something I want to say," my voice cracked. "I want to say that as much as I love Edward and love being married, which I really do, there is no relationship that has been more..." "I know where you're going," she said. "Should I go there anyway?" "Yes." "So, Meg, I know this isn't the way it's supposed to be. And I know I can't say what it'd be like to be a single mom. But given everything I do know, no matter how hard it is, how lonely or stressful, still, I would not want to leave this earth without being a mother." She nodded. "And you, Meg, I think you in particular were born to be somebody's mother." She hit her blinker and switched lanes. I rode out the silence. I had said plenty. "I think," she said through tears, "I think I could be a really good mom." We sat with that for a minute, and then she added, "I went to a sperm bank website."
"You did?"
"I did." Before we take a short break, let me just thank my production partner on the How Change Happens series, the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations, supporting inclusive higher education and healthcare, vibrant spiritual communities, and a clean environment. The Arthur Vining Davis Foundations, investing in our common future. We'll be right back with Lori Gottlieb, the therapist who wrote the best-selling memoir, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. This episode was funded by the great people at the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations. You can learn more about this fantastic organization at avdf.org. The Arthur Vining Davis Foundations, investing in our common future. When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are just right for the role you've got. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. It has a vast network of more than a billion professionals, which makes it the best place to hire. LinkedIn gives you access to professionals you can't find anywhere else, all the while making the process easy and intuitive. I mean, when you have that many quality candidates, hiring gets a lot easier. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. So maybe you're 24 hours from finding your perfect next hire. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/Kelly. That's linkedin.com/Kelly to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. The 10% Happier podcast has one guiding philosophy: Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? Hosted by Dan Harris, a journalist who had a panic attack on national television and then set out on a journey of transformation. He's now on a quest to help others also achieve peace and happiness. Every week, Dan talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity in wide-ranging conversations that explore topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. The interviews cover everyone from Brené Brown to Alexander Draymond to Sam Harris. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. Find 10% Happier wherever you listen to podcasts. Hey, welcome back to Kelly Corrigan Wonders. We're talking with Lori Gottlieb, the therapist who first made waves back in 2008 with this article encouraging women to stop seeking perfection and to go ahead and settle for Mr. Good Enough. She's also the author of the best-selling book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. Hey, Lori, thanks so much for saying yes.
Oh, of course. My pleasure.
So we have mutual friends, so it's super great to finally meet you because I can't tell you how many people have said, you haven't met Lori Gottlieb yet? Like, you guys are birds of a feather. So welcome to Kelly Corrigan Wonders.
Well, thank you. I have been a fan of your work for years and years and years, so this is just such a thrill for me.
So it is early January 2021. We have made it across the finish line and into a new year, and in the spirit of all great New Years, there is, I think, a sense of change in the air. And so we are in the middle of a 10-part series about how change actually happens. We have 5 episodes on how societies change, how cultures change, how neighborhoods change, how the planet will change. And then we have 5 episodes specifically about how personal change happens. So I wanted to do a deep dive into the story of you becoming a mother. Because really, what is a bigger change in a person's life than parenthood? Your journey wasn't easy, and it took a lot of weird twists and turns. So, at 34, you met a guy.
Yep.
And you loved the guy.
I did, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that relationship.
I had just come back from the Bay Area to Los Angeles and pretty immediately met this guy. And at 34... I was really, really ready to find the person that I was going to spend my life with. I thought he was the one. He was the one I was going to spend my life with. And he's a great guy. And we dated. I think we realized, but we didn't realize because we really wanted to be together. But there were these differences that we had. And they were kind of profound differences in terms of how we viewed the world. But then there were all these other great things, as there are sometimes in relationships. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, we ended up breaking up because we were not the right people for each other. So it was a good thing that we broke up. When I look back on that, I feel very good about that decision. But the timing could not have been worse, especially for somebody like me. I always knew I wanted to be a mother.
Yeah, me too.
I always knew that I wanted to have that experience. And so I was really worried about how that was going to happen. Now I was 37 and time was of the essence.
Yeah. So I have a great friend named Meg, who I wrote about a lot in Lyft, and she was also getting into the late 30s, early 40s, and had not found Mr. Right and was grappling with the same choices that were in front of you. What was your thinking process like when you were sort of looking at your options at 37 and single?
Near the end of that relationship, so when I was 36, I was getting all of this advice from friends. And some people were saying, well, he's a great guy, you should get married. And I was like, I don't know, this doesn't feel right about this. Or just, I worry about marrying someone with so many reservations in my head. Mm. And then this one friend said this thing that just blew me away. She said, you could have a baby on your own. Mm. And I just laughed. I remember laughing. I had not heard of this. This was much less common back then. To me, the idea of planning to have a baby on your own was something I had never heard of. Of course, I had heard about single parents, but it was because something unplanned had happened.
Right.
Like you got divorced or you accidentally got pregnant. It wasn't you were going to intentionally do this.
Right. I was that friend to Meg.
Oh, wow.
Uh-huh. So I'm intrigued to think it through from the other side of the story. So you're sort of blown away. And are you like thinking about it as you're going to sleep? Like, what was she talking about? Would I really do that? What would that be like? What would my parents think? What would my old boyfriend think?
Well, first of all, I was still in a relationship with him. So it was in that decision point of, do I go ahead with this or do I not go ahead with this? And what would my life look like? And would I have the opportunity to become a mother? And then do you marry somebody that you really love and care about, but who you have so many reservations about in terms of the relationship, mm-hmm. So that you can become a mother, which just felt wrong to me on so many levels.
When I was dating in my 20s, if you gave me a truth serum, what I would have said is I'd rather marry the wrong person than not get married. That's the real truth of how I felt. Like I really wanted the same thing you wanted. I wanted a husband and some kids. And I think I might have wanted it so much that I would have suppressed whatever misgivings I might have had.
And that's exactly the advice that every single friend gave me, wow. except for that one friend who told me about this thing called sperm donors.
Wow. People actually said to you, go ahead and get married. Don't worry about it. Keep moving.
My best friend from college, the person I'm closest to in the world, gave me that advice. All of my friends. I mean, every single person said, because he is a great guy. You know, I mean, right. you have to remember, it wasn't like get into this relationship with this terrible person. He's a great person.
Right.
He was not the person for me.
You know what's so interesting about that is that, I mean, this is known, right? That there's how a thing presents, like your relationship with this super great guy. And then there's the things only you know. And that's why advice and therapy can be tricky, because if you don't cough up what you secretly know to your best friend or your therapist, then the advice they give you is based on only half the story. Like you have secret experiences with him that may be either so private that you don't want to share them or so difficult to articulate and represent that whoever's taking you in can't possibly give you the right advice because you can't possibly give them the full sweep of the story.
There's a big difference between talking to a therapist and talking to a friend. And I was not seeing a therapist at that time. So I was only talking to my friends. I talk in my book about the difference between idiot compassion and wise compassion. And maybe you should talk to someone. I talk about how idiot compassion is what we do with our friends. Our friends tell us something and we back them up. We think that's being supportive. So they say, this is what happened with my partner, my sibling, my coworker, my mother, or whatever. And we say, yeah, they were wrong. You were right.
Yeah.
You know, that's terrible that they did that. What a jerk. Yeah. And so they just automatically back you up, but they don't help you to see something about yourself. And if you listen to your friends, often you'll hear patterns like, oh, you know, she tends to be the victim in these situations, or she tends to misinterpret this, or, oh, she has some responsibility in this too, but I don't really want to bring that up with her because she'll get mad at me or think I'm not being supportive. It's kind of like if a fight breaks out in every bar you're going to, maybe it's you. Yeah. We do not say that in idiot compassion.
I know. It's so hard. And I feel that temptation to be the person who says, well, wait a minute, like this seems sort of unfair. There's just a handful of people maybe in your whole life that you could get to a place of such trust that you would actually be able to give the wise compassion rather than the idiot compassion.
Right. The wise compassion is what you get in therapy. It's where a therapist will hold up a mirror to you and help you to see something that maybe you're a little bit reluctant to see about yourself. So I was sort of, you know, I call this jokingly cheating on my boyfriend. How I was cheating on my boyfriend was at night, I would go into a different room and I would look at the sperm donor sites just to see what was out there. So I wasn't looking for another boyfriend, right? It wasn't like I was right. online dating. I was online mating. Right. I was looking to see like, well, what are these sperm donor sites? What is out there? You know, what are the possibilities for me if I don't go through with this?
Nothing is trippier than like the cryobank.
Oh my gosh, nothing. It's like, how do you even know what to look for?
Right. Like what schools they went to, how tall they are, if they played lacrosse, if they like chess. Like it's so odd.
I know. And at the end of the day, I chose someone that I felt like I wanted to have dinner with every night. What I mean by that is like, if there's any genetic relationship between, you know, someone's personality and their offspring, I thought, I want someone that I just truly like. And I think that's what we look for when we're dating, right? It's like, you might say, oh, I wish I had someone who was this height, or, you know, whatever it is that you think you're looking for. But when you actually meet the person that you fall in love with, it's the person you fall in love with. It's not necessarily going to check off all of those boxes. It's the person that you enjoy being around. And I think that that's how I felt, weirdly, even though I was really choosing genetic material. I wanted that intangible sense of connection with the person. Like, I wanted to feel like if I met this person in real life, I would like this person.
But the other thing about the way that they categorize all this stuff in these binders or on these websites is that there are little notes that are put in by the people who work there. And that was like this huge source of insight for you, right?
It was. They were called staff impressions, which I found hilarious because basically somebody's coming in to donate their sperm and, you know, how much of an impression are you going to get really? Before they go in their little room and do their thing? Oh, so, you know, I don't even want to think about that. And so there was this one woman at the sperm bank that I was looking at, and I ended up calling her my sperm concierge, but I would ask these questions the way a journalist does and just like get information from her.
Good girl.
It was one donor I remember where I was thinking of using him, and I was like, you know, what about him? And she's like, well, I wouldn't look twice at him in the subway, you know, like he's fine, but you know, and I was like, okay, he's out. You know, and there were just like, she was just so honest.
Well, you know, it's funny when you think about like Malcolm Gladwell and Blink and this like rapid cognition stuff that says that we are sort of tuned, we're always honing our ability to make a snap judgment about a person. It does sort of give some validity to staff impressions that like maybe your sperm concierge, you know, was using her rapid cognition to say, here's my take.
Yes.
Here's my whiff on this guy. And I think I'm probably right.
Well, also there was something important to me about someone who had met this person in person. Mm-hmm. Well, so what happened was when this donor popped up, I had been looking for a long time.
And you've been in this search now for over a year. You've been snooping around sperm donors.
I broke up with the boyfriend, and then I really, in earnest, started my search. And I just really couldn't find the one that I felt comfortable with. What happened was I got a call from my sperm concierge, and she's like, Lori, you've got to look at this one, right? I get this voicemail, and I'm like, oh my gosh. Like the minute I saw the profile, I said, this is the one. This is the one I have been waiting for. But the more I read, the more I was like, yes, finally. And I was so relieved. I'm like, this is my birthday present. Oh. This is my 38th birthday present. Here is the guy. I'm going to have a baby. This is a reality now.
Yeah.
And I go to order the sperm. And I get this, you know, like that circle that you get when like something's not working on your computer.
Beach ball of death, we call it.
Yes. Yeah. The beach ball of death. It turns out that what pops up on my screen is a notice that says, we're sorry, out of stock. And I'm like, wait a minute, out of stock. Oh, I'm sorry. You've chosen a very popular donor. He is now on back order. So I was just devastated. I felt really hopeless. I started to lower expectations for my life. Mm. And by that, I mean, I started to say, well, maybe I can be in a marriage that maybe isn't the marriage that I hope it will be, but it will be, you know, with a good person. There was something very strong in me. Just, I always knew I wanted to be a parent, and to have that dream feel like it might not be attainable just started to feel like I got into sort of desperation mode. And what happened was I was sitting there just really despondent through my tears. I see on the corner of my desk, this business card. And it was from this guy that I had met recently at a professional networking event. And he was 10 years younger than me. He didn't give me his card for dating purposes. It was networking. We were in the same industry. And I just remembered I talked to him for maybe 5 minutes, and he was really good looking, and he had gone to Harvard, and he was so cute and kind. And I was like, him. He should be my sperm donor. Like, he would be the perfect sperm donor.
Oh my God. This is such a movie. Like, you wiping away your tears and being like, plan B.
Plan C at that point, right? Because plan A was get married. Plan B was do the sperm donor thing. Plan C is contact a total stranger.
Weird guy from the networking.
Right. That you met and ask him to be your sperm donor. Like nobody thinks that is going to be my life. That at 38, I'm going to be sitting there doing that. Nobody plans for that. I'm 38 and I don't have a lot of time. And I see this business card and I think, you know, it wasn't even like, is this rational? It was just like, I have to do this. So I sent him an email. Just said, like, I have an unusual question. I met you at that networking event. Do you think we could meet for coffee? And he writes back, can you tell me what the question is? And I'm like, let's just meet for coffee. and like, I don't get an email back immediately, right? So he kind of pondered it and then he wrote back, sure. And so we decided to meet. The minute I get there, we sit down and I'm immediately just in conversation with him and we're just really relaxed and we're having a great conversation. And then finally, I just said it. I just said, look, I really want to have a baby. I'm 38. I've been looking at these sperm banks. I met you at this thing and I just thought you're the kind of person that I'm looking for. And I wonder if you would be, you know, interested in doing this. I mean, it was so awkward. I can't even say it now. All these thoughts are going through my head and I start to apologize. And before I can even get the words out, he says, well, I certainly wasn't expecting that to be your question. And then I again start to apologize and he says, but I'd be willing to talk about it. Mm. And then I freeze because I am so stunned and I am so grateful. I can't believe it. And so at the end of that conversation, he says, you know, he walks me to my car, we walk out and he says, I need to give this thought, obviously. And I said, of course. And he said, I'll get back to you. And that was that. And I think he's never going to do this. Like he was being nice. He's going to think about this. He's going to tell his friends and his friends are going to go, dude,
yeah, for sure.
You're 27 years old. That is crazy. Like, why are you going to do that? You're going to have a child out there who's not yours. Like, you don't know this woman. Like, this is insane.
Yeah.
So I get an email from him later that night. And he says, so far I am a yes, but with more questions. So I go to meet him again. We have many meetings. And for a 27-year-old guy, he was incredible. We thought about the world in a lot of the same ways. And we had a lot of like shared interests. We read the same things. We liked the same movies, you know, those kinds of things too.
A million points of validation. Like you must be feeling more and more certain with every conversation. Like, look at the way this is teeing up. Like we just keep matching each other.
Right. I was certain. It was a question of, is he certain? So we had to like go through all these permutations of what might happen. And then we got down to the brass tacks of like, well, are you going to go to the fertility clinic and donate sperm or, you know, should we have sex? And, you know,
you just want to get a little drunk and come on over to my house?
Well, I will tell you, he picked sex.
Nice.
And this guy was gorgeous.
And he's 10 years younger. You're like, uh-huh, okay.
So it's like everything is aligning here. And also it's easier to get pregnant when you have sex. So that was the plan. And then we were all ready to go. We had contracts. We had like, you know, all this stuff.
Wow.
And we took this walk on the beach and it was Los Angeles where it rarely rains. And all of a sudden, for some reason, it started raining. And he hadn't given me like his final, like, yes, we're doing that. It was like, we had the contract and I just wanted to make sure like there was no doubt in his mind.
Yeah.
So we take this walk and we're having this like beautiful conversation. And it starts raining. He has this jacket that's around his waist and he like puts it over me and he's, you know, I'm 5'2" and he's like 6'2". And so his jacket is like a dress on me and he like puts it over my shoulders and we're standing there in the rain and I'm standing there with this man who's going to be the father of my child and give me this gift of letting me become a mom. And he says, you know, we're going to make this baby for you. And he's in, and it was like this beautiful moment. And I was so happy. So then I get like the ovulation kits are happening and the whole thing is happening and he's not responding. And I don't know what's going on. I'm like, that's not like him. And so I'm thinking, wait a minute. This is never a good sign. And finally he responds and he says, we need to talk. And I just knew. I mean, what else could that mean? So we go back. I see him sitting at our table. I walk in. he, the whole vibe is different, like body language, everything is different. And it's like a breakup conversation, you know, where the person doesn't want to hurt you. He says, I thought I was ready to do this, but I'm just not ready for this level of commitment.
Not you, it's me.
It's not you, it's me. And I really tried not to cry. And in fact, I tried to kind of be strong. And I made this lame joke. I said, that's okay. There are other fish in the sea, like a pun on, right? I mean, it was just terrible. It was a very, very horrible moment. And it was horrible because when you want to have a baby, babies are everywhere. Like you'll walk down the street and you see the strollers and I just would burst into tears on the street. I couldn't handle it. Or you're watching TV and you're like, oh, this is a great show. And then like this commercial comes on for diapers and you see that cute little baby butt and the baby's kind of like, you know, and you're like, I would have been how many months pregnant right now?
You really mourn it. You really mourn it.
It's a loss. It's such a loss. And I think, you know, and maybe you should talk to someone in my book, I talk about this hierarchy of grief. You know, let's say they have a miscarriage, but they didn't lose like an 8-year-old child, or it's a breakup, but it's not a divorce of a marriage of 20 years. They're kind of silent losses. Like people don't realize how much grief there is, how much loss there is. And I wasn't a therapist back then. Mm-hmm.
And also people don't feel entitled to their grief. Like, because it was just a breakup and not a divorce, you feel like a whiner for saying, God, I'm really, this one's killing me. Like this is really like ripping me up. Or I know so many people have had miscarriages who feel like there's not like a whole lot of sympathy out there in the world for people who have miscarriages, especially people who already have children.
Yes.
But nonetheless, like these are like terrible moments in people's lives and they don't feel comfortable. They don't feel safe sort of openly feeling that.
Right, right.
Which makes other people who are going through it not want to openly feel it either, which like clams everybody up, which isn't the direction we want to go at all.
That's right. That there are these kinds of losses that if they aren't these socially accepted ones that you're allowed to talk about, then people suffer in silence. And that's what I did.
Yeah.
You know, like how could you say, I'm devastated and I'm like curled up in the fetal position in my bed because this guy said he's not going to be my sperm donor. That's the very simplified version of the story. But you don't take into account that every time you imagine, like with the original sperm donor from the sperm bank, I pictured that baby. Like it was real all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. I imagined that baby. That baby was tangible to me. And then I lost the baby. Same thing with this guy. I mean, it was months of these conversations. And every time it was like we were moving forward and it was one step closer to this baby. And the minute he was like, so far I'm a yes, but with more questions, I pictured that baby. I held that baby. I imagined that baby in preschool. I was like decorating the room in my head of like the nursery.
Sure. And
so I lost a baby, really. But people don't understand that. And so it was the second baby that I lost. Yeah. And I'm 38. And people would say things to me like, well, just adopt. And they don't realize that that's a years long process. You can have the rug pulled out from under you there. I know so many people who tried to adopt and then things change or it doesn't come through or the mother changes her mind or whatever happens. And so there's no
it
sure
thing.
It is
a massive project.
It is. You have to get accepted by the birth parent. I mean, it's a whole thing. And so I was really devastated, but my heart is so broken right now that I can't do this. It's kind of like how people feel with dating too, that like they've gone through something and they need a break. They need some space. Yeah. So I took that space and a few months later, and I didn't want to wait too long because of, again, the ticking clock. I decide that I'm ready. I'm going to go back and I'm going to look again. And I get a call from my sperm concierge. She was kind of like, you know, this like Italian mother, right?
Uh-huh.
She was so funny. And she was like, I forgot to mention that one of the things that they said in the staff impressions was, he looks like a young George Clooney. That was how they described him. So I get this message from her. Remember the Clooney kid? The Clooney kid that you wanted? The Clooney kid is available again. But if you want it, you need to get it right now because there's a long wait list. And I was like, I'm in. Because if I didn't take it that minute, somebody else would.
That's kind of a gift for you. I mean, maybe you wouldn't have wavered anyway, but sometimes I think about decision fatigue and how prone we are to overthink things. And so maybe there's a gift in her saying it's like now or never. Did you get pregnant right away?
The first time I tried, I did not get pregnant. And then the second time, I didn't want to get my hopes up. And so I was sure I was not pregnant the second time because they said, like, you know, the timing wasn't right. So what did I do? I did the thing. And instead of like leaving your legs in the air and bed rest and all this stuff, what did I do? I went running.
Oh my God, Lori. That is a weird choice.
Well, I was just like, I'm going to pretend that I'm not pregnant because they're saying there's like very little chance anyway. So I'm just going to go on with my life. I'm not going to go do everything that I, you know, all those things. And so I just lived my life as
that might break your heart.
Right.
Really.
Well, my heart.
Like the more you invest in a thing, the more you, every minute you spend trying to make a thing happen is more investment.
I couldn't allow myself to invest myself in the possibility of being pregnant. I was like, I'm going to wait for the definitive when we will know test. And I was pregnant.
Well,
and that is my son.
And how old is he?
He's 14.
Aww.
He's 14. He's way taller than me.
Does he look like George Clooney?
It's so funny. you know, they were right about that. I mean, he's a really good looking kid and it's not my genes. So... like he does not look like me. He looks so much like you know, like the donor side.
That's amazing. What an amazing story. Thank you so much, Lori.
Oh, my pleasure.
I'm so grateful for this job for so many reasons, but conversations like the ones I had today really get me thinking. Here are the notes I wrote down. One, being a definitively supportive person is a most admirable mission. 2, health insurance is a non-negotiable. 3, it's heavenly to hear a very smart woman say repeatedly, I don't have the answers. I don't know for sure. 4, idiot compassion is real. You can't always trust your best friend's advice. 5, when shopping for sperm, get to know the staffers who hand out the specimen cups and know which guy looked like George Clooney. 6, people change their minds all the time. It's important to make space for that. And 7, maybe God is in the science. I want to thank Dr. Tracy Defina, Dr. Lori Gottlieb. I want to thank my friend Meg Garlinghouse. I want to thank Dean Kateri and Susan George for making every episode of this podcast with good humor and high standards. I want to thank the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations and you guys, the listeners, especially those of you who are spreading the word about Kelly Corrigan Wonders through posts and reviews like D&J in LA, Zach K, and Mavis M. Your feedback and support totally keep us going on this labor of love. We'll see you next week.